Come on aboard, I promise you. Lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
John Steinbacher.
Hey, it's great to be back with everybody again this week. Great show coming up. We'll talk with University of Illinois softball standout Nicole Evans here in just a bit, and we'll also get kind of an inside look at the Kentucky Derby, which is coming up this weekend. And Molly Pagansky, is that the name, John?
That's the name.
All right. One of John's friends who lives in Louisville.
Or used to.
Used to live in Louisville. Sorry. Where does she live now?
Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. All right. We'll talk with Molly about the Kentucky Derby coming up as well. Busy weekend around here in Champaign-Urbana last week. Ebert Fest going on. The Illinois Marathon festivities and all the races going on as well. And
there's also a March for Science.
There was a March for Science.
I was reminded that the March for Science also happened. And there were a lot of people there, too.
There were. I think more than 1,000, if I recall correctly, at the March for Science.
Record store day.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
Just so many things going on here in Champaign-Urbana. John and I ran together Friday night at the 5K, and I want to thank John because he probably could have smoked me, but instead he waited back. He knew I had to run the 10K again the next morning, so he waited for me. So we crossed the finish line together. It was very nice of you, John.
Yeah, although I have to say the News Gazette published the results, and you were two people in front of me, even though we had the same time. I'm going to blame the alphabet on that one. it was actually pretty fun. You know, I have talked about my disinterest in running with other people before. Because it's sort of like a way to get away when I run. But it was great. Thousands of people, including a lot of other WILL folks. We saw Mike Thomas there who works here. I don't know. It was perfect temperature. I was pumped. I think it being my first one, I probably could have really gotten out really early. And luckily you were like, don't do that. So.
Yeah. I kind of tried to hold us back a little bit at the start because the adrenaline will start pumping out at the start
line. And then
you'll
be dead by mile two.
Can you describe the course that they – because, you know, as we'll talk about, I got kind of familiar with the marathon course if only by a map. But how is the 5K
5K routed? Course, you start on Oak Street right by the Research Park. Just south of St. Mary's a little ways.
Okay, so that's on the – for those who aren't in town, that's like on the south end of town.
Yeah, the southwestern edge of campus basically. And then you run north on Oak and then go east. Is it on Gregory, John? I can't remember when we turned east, but you go east through campus.
Yeah, I mean you go down first and then you run on Green.
Yeah.
And then you go back up. I mean, it's a pretty short course compared to the other ones.
But yeah, 3.1.
You get to run down Crean Street, and that was fun because there's a lot of people with signs, and then there's a lot of college students who are like, what the hell is going on? I just want to get to Murphy's and have a few drinks.
Where's the finish line?
Inside the stadium.
It's in the stadium. So it's the same finish line as the next day. That's awesome.
Yeah, so that was good. And I understand your son ran the full marathon.
Yes, he came down from Chicago to run the full marathon, and I kind of liken it to the time that he told us he was in a musical at school, and I was like, great. And he had been cast as one of the leads. This was in eighth grade, but I had never heard him sing or practice or anything at home. Mm. Like, I know he went to practice, but like, I didn't know he knew how to sing. I didn't know what it was going to be like. I asked him if, can I help you with your lines? Nope, I'm good. So the night of the opening night of the show, I'm like completely riddled with anxiety because I don't know how this is going to turn out. How could he possibly be ready? He opens his mouth and this beautiful like noise comes out. And it was very much the same with the marathon. Of course, he's 24 now. He's not in eighth grade. He had been doing the training. He ran a little cross country in high school, but I said, have you been doing like the long runs? And he's like, oh yeah, he's in school up there now. So, yeah, he finished, and he finished – he beat his goal time that he wanted. He wanted to get 4 hours or below, and he came in at 3:57, I think.
That's very impressive.
Yeah. So as a spectator, I know the weather was perfect for running like the night before and then that day. But as a spectator, it was cold.
Yes.
And windy. I was wearing lots of long underwear. So, of course, I was also very concerned that he was going to be freezing while he was out there. And he's like, yeah, that wasn't a problem. I will say they had an app this year where you could track your runner's progress. So that was it wasn't perfect. I don't think it was like real time tracking. I think they would like check in every couple of minutes and then that sort of estimate where people were. So when I tried to meet him at the half where the half marathon and the full marathon split, I think I was too late. But the person playing violin next to me was playing Star Wars music. So that was kind of fun. We saw Rob Cantor from Environmental Almanac, somebody who contributes to WILL there as well while I was there. But then I was telling you guys off mic, like, it's really lonely while you're waiting in the stadium for your person to finish. Like, you don't really want to go anywhere else. There is nowhere else to go. I got some food from a food truck and then came back in the stadium and started watching people finish. And you have, at the end of the race, I don't know if you guys had this at the end of your race, but you have, like, the English guy yelling encouragement or somebody from a radio station. They're playing really bad 80s music, like Tina Turner and stuff. I mean, she's great, but, like, you know, she was playing with some 80s rock band or something. And so you're just kind of waiting. And I'm watching the app. Like, thinking to myself, if it stops, I know he's, like, you know, fallen down and can't get up or whatever. So, but, you know, when he finished, he just trotted right across the finish line. Like, he was exhausted, but he was in a lot better shape at the end than I was expecting. Like, his feet were not bleeding. He was not bleeding. He was in a great mood, like, super pumped, wanted to eat all the things after about an hour, after we got home. So, he didn't barf. Like, it was great. He wants to do another one. He's already preparing to go up to Minneapolis-St. Paul to do the Twin Cities Marathon on October 1st. So, yeah, it was awesome.
Very good indeed.
And it was fun to watch people finishing, relay teams, you know, people who are clearly running together. I always get really inspired every year. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to run something next year, and I never do.
Yeah, and the Illinois Marathon happens just a few days after Boston. John, and, you know, University of Illinois always has a strong presence at Boston, particularly in the wheelchair events, and that was certainly no different this year.
Yeah, I believe the University of Illinois in the women's division, they had number 2, 3, 4, and 5, which is very impressive. We're all from the University of Illinois or had some sort of connection. Our superstar, Tatiana McFadden, did not win, which, you know, she's been kind of cleaning up for a while now. But I understand, and she didn't obviously make this public before the race, but she had a sort of – she's had issues this year with blood clots, and it came up again. And she was, like, in the hospital, like, a week or so beforehand. So she didn't win, but she continues to be very, very inspiring.
Yeah, she only finished fourth,
right.
despite being in the hospital with blood clots for a week or two before the race. So we'll see. I think she decided not to go to London just because of those blood clot issues. The London Marathon is like a week after Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And in past years, she had gone and run both of those races and won both of those races, but decided not to take any chances with travel this time around.
I'm curious how profession, and I think about this for all marathoners, how do you route, how do you decide which races you're going to do? How much time do you have between races? Can you just go bang another one out like a week later, 2 weeks later? How does that work?
If you're a professional, I think so. I mean, they probably all run 20 miles a day or something like that.
Well, I think for, you know, the elite runners, they don't do that very often as far as I know, and I don't follow it as close as some, but you know, they will kind of shoot for maybe one or two huge races a year and really gauge their training. For marathoners, anyway, they'll gauge their training toward those. Maybe three or four on the high side. But like for runners, there aren't many that are running both Boston and London.
Fascinating.
Right.
Yeah, and wheelchair athletes, I don't know if it's just the wear and tear is a little bit different than it is for the runners, but that what Tatiana has done the last few years, doing both of those races back to back, is just incredible.
Yeah, I was also surprised to learn that in order to You don't just finish the Illinois Marathon and you can run in the Boston Marathon. You have to get specific times and they vary by age group. So even while I was thinking, Cody, my son, he crushed it. He's like, yeah, but I would never have I mean, I'm an hour away from qualifying for Boston. I was like, seriously?
Yeah.
So I was unaware that they had, like, certain marathons have this criteria where you have to have finished. You can't just have run in a race and finished it. You have to, like, run a 305 marathon or whatever it was.
Boston has those times. I think New York, if you want to automatically qualify, New York has times like that. Otherwise, you can enter in, like, a drawing randomly to get an entry otherwise.
Yeah. Well, so. I feel like it's a lottery for Boston anyway. Like, people, you can qualify for Boston, but that doesn't mean you're going to be chosen to run.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Which I thought was kind of wild.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway, busy marathon season. And, John, again, great running with you at Illinois in the 5K. And John and I had kicked around the idea of perhaps putting together a WILL marathon relay team next year. We'll see if that happens or not.
Yeah, how was your 10K?
10K was good, just under 51 minutes, which, if you asked me before the race what I wanted to run, maybe a minute faster or so, but I'll take it.
Yeah, top 10 in your age group, right?
I did.
Oh, that's right.
I did. That was fun.
Nicely done.
Not that I get anything for that, but...
just the good vibes.
That's right. The pride.
Mm-hmm.
The pride. So another Illinois Marathon in the books. And coming up, stay with us. We've got a lot more to come on the bandwagon. First up, we'll hear from Nicole Evans, University of Illinois softball standout. And we'll check in on the Kentucky Derby with someone who's been a local down in that part of the country. We'll talk to Molly Pagansky as well. That's coming up on the bandwagon. Fighting Illini softball team having one of their best seasons in quite a while, 34-11 on the season, nationally ranked, and one of their outstanding players is senior outfielder Nicole Evans, who's kind enough to join us here in our bandwagon studios today. How you doing, Nicole?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. You've been getting some hardware here lately. Big Ten Medal of Honor at the recent OSCE Awards at the State Farm Center earlier this week, and another honor nationally, the Arthur Ashe Award. I'm curious. I think we're fairly familiar with the Big Ten Medal of Honor, but tell us a little bit about the Arthur Ashe Award you received.
It's an award to honor Arthur Ashe Jr., who was a great tennis player, humanitarian, who really did a lot for the communities that he worked in. I can't even explain the honor. There are so many people, throughout the country who deserved it, people who've won it that I look to, who have been really mentors, and I've looked up to them throughout my life. So it's really beyond words to even receive that award, to have been nominated for it.
Yeah, where did you go for that ceremony?
I went to Richmond, Virginia, and had never been there before. It was absolutely beautiful and 80 degrees. so it was beautiful. The University of Richmond did a great job, and the diverse staff, did everything they could for us.
Yeah, outstanding. And let's talk about your team this year. You guys had a good season last year. You went to the NCAA regionals, were really close to forcing a winner-take-all game against the host team Kentucky there last year. But you've taken it even a step better so far this season. What do you think has been the key to this outstanding year so far?
I think last year helped us out a lot, going and seeing that the teams that we're playing are just teams, and they have weaknesses that we can expose, and I think giving us that confidence helped us a lot. And then our people who came in this year, our transfers are doing a great job, our freshmen are doing a great job helping out the team, and then obviously our coaching staff really pushing us to our limits, pushing us past really what we thought we could do.
So I have a question about your background as a player. So you grew up in the suburbs, mm-hmm. Glen Ellen?
Yes, I grew up in Forest Park, and then I moved to Glen Ellen during high school.
Okay, so I'm very familiar with, like, the club soccer scene because that's mm-hmm. what my daughter did. But I'm curious to know what kind of opportunities exist for softball players in the burbs and on the club scene. And did you play other sports before really deciding on softball? Describe your path.
Definitely. I started, like, gymnastics, tap, that kind of thing. I didn't like the fancy outfits, so then I started playing soccer, and that was way too much running. So then I went to softball. Like club soccer, there's club softball. So you would go on the weekends, basically, work out with your team, and then you play high school. And during high school is kind of the dead period, which is really nice, just be with your high school team. And then you go back in the summers, and you'll play, I remember metros. You go in and you start at an 8 o'clock game and you get out of there at 8 o'clock at night, which is pretty usual for travel. But there are a lot of opportunities, and that really, you know, lets you – that's how I traveled. That's let me see the country, traveled to Pennsylvania, Colorado a few times, California for the first time I flew. Mm-hmm. So it was – it really opened up my horizons.
So how was the transition from that to college? You know, in terms of like your academic workload is going to be a little bit different, and the training schedule is probably different. You're probably doing some training in the off season. So how was that transition for you?
Definitely. I had never really lifted until I got here, and I absolutely love working out, lifting and all that now. But like you said, learning to work with your academic schedule, I was blessed enough to be in the IB program in high school, and it kind of taught me how to study, which I think I had a leg up on that. But yeah, you're spending hours on planes and buses trying not to get car sick reading, but you figure it out. You figure out how to work your schedule. And I mean, we have all the resources that we could have, tutors, people working with us on the road. So the University of Illinois treats us, you know, as best as they can and do a great job.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious, Nicole. You know, with college softball, as you kind of look around the sport, you don't see a huge number of African American players and coaches. You know, who were some of your role models as you were kind of coming through high school and travel ball? Players that you looked up, coaches that you looked up to, who kind of served as role models for you?
Definitely. We were just actually in Nebraska, and there's a huge picture of Peaches James, who was a pitcher. People like, you know, Watkins, Wally, all those people who I grew up watching. And then just having Coach Perry, I think, is really a beacon of hope for, you know, little girls playing who don't necessarily see so many people like them playing. And we don't only have Coach Perry, we have Coach Liv, who is actually playing in the NPF right now. I mean, Coach Liv is one of our biggest assets that we have right now. She really works with us, works on our mental game, is there really whenever we need her to be, and goes out of her way to do whatever she can for the team. So, I mean, Coach Liv is really a testament to being a softball player and being a role model for us. But, yeah, like you said, growing up there wasn't very many people who looked like me, grew up like me playing softball. I really hope that I'm inspiring some people to play, get out in the sport, opening up some eyes, and bring a little diversity to the sport.
Yeah, you mentioned NPF, National Professional Fast Pitch. Is that something you hope to take part in once your college career is done?
I hope to. Kind of working out some things right now. It's a great league. I think it's really inspiring some young girls to go out and, you know, be active, play softball, and love the game. And the community service that they do in that league is amazing.
Can you talk more about that league and, like, how it works? Because I don't know anything about it. So how are the players paid? Is there a draft? Like, how does it work to enter that league? And then can you make a living playing softball?
Yeah, I will tell you all I know. So so the draft just happened on Monday. 26 people get drafted, which is, you know, roughly one team. It's not very many people. And a lot of them are pitchers. Really, really good people who get drafted. MJ from Nebraska got drafted. Kelly Christner from Michigan just got drafted. You know, a lot of our pitchers and then a few position players. So after that, you can become a free agent. And then you can only contact them, obviously, after your season's over. So you contact them and they get in touch with you, possibly playing on their teams. And then every team has kind of walk-on tryouts. So girls from around the country will try out for that. The interesting thing about this year is the national team, because softball was just put back into the Olympics. Mm. So there's kind of this odd dichotomy between going to the national team, trying out for that, which, you know, has already been in the works, and then playing NPF. So there's a lot of opportunities this year. So that's how it works. Making a living, not so much. You know, some people, we just had our first $1 million contract for the NPF last year or 2 years ago, for, you know, one of the most dominant pitchers, Monica Abbott. And then everybody else can get paid. It's kind of like a summer job. I don't want to, you know, put it down to that level, but you can get, I think it's, you can make anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000, depending, you know, on what level you're, how long you've been in the league. But a lot of the women who play have coaching jobs, other jobs that they play and work out during the school year. Allie played last year, Allie Balk from our team last year. did a great job, but she's now teaching, and then she goes and plays in the summer. So kind of works like that. Everyone kind of has their own path and works it into their life.
So there's a player in the league who makes $1 million or,
yes.
or like her contract, and then everybody else. Is that kind of like – what do people think of that, or what do the players think of that?
It's really interesting because, you know – My football friends, my baseball friends will come and say, so, you know, if you get drafted, if you go play, it's going to be your living, right? And it's kind of like, no, it's just you play because you love the sport. And I think that really helps our sport, actually. The only people playing are really, you're not playing for the money, necessarily. You're going to play because you love the sport. You want to inspire some young girls. And then, you know, the people who do make careers out of it, a lot of them play overseas. So it's huge in Japan. You can make a living over there out of it. But, I mean, the people who are playing and making a lot of money really started just because they loved the game, and I think that really helps.
And as a senior who plans to continue to play at least a little bit, also, what are your other plans? I see you're planning to go to grad school here.
Yes, I'm accepted into grad school here, so I'm really excited to stay. I'm going to plan to grad assist with the team next year, stay around and help out all that I can. And really, I'm not ready to leave this place. It's too great of a place to leave in just 4 short years. So really, you know, hoping to see what I haven't seen in my undergrad.
Now, just looking ahead at your schedule here a little bit, you've got a series at home this weekend against Wisconsin. They're pretty solid.
Yes.
Northwestern next week. They've always got a pretty good team. And then mm-hmm. you close out with Ohio State. That should be a tough series as well. So what are you guys, hoping to do to finish strong here?
Definitely. And like you said, all tough components, opponents. We just played Nebraska, and every team that we're going to play from now on is similar. You know, very gritty teams, tough programs, historically good teams. So we're just going out and not even really focusing on other teams, just playing our game. Because when we play our game, I really believe the team believes nobody can hang with us. When we're hitting 1 through 9, when our pitchers are on, it's really, really tough to beat our team.
I have a completely unrelated question. I feel like I'm asking things out of sequence, but I'm curious, and this is a total U-turn, about the philanthropic part of what mm-hmm. you do. And I've been thinking a lot recently about philanthropy in sports and how some athletes seem to come by this concept of paying it forward really naturally. Like they're very involved with a lot of different causes, and it's really easy for them. It's not just about the photo op of seeing the sick kid in the hospital or something, but it's very genuine. And a lot of athletes are pretty quiet about their philanthropy, too. How did you get involved with the causes that you're involved with? Is it easy for you? It seems like it comes very naturally to you to want to pay that forward. But I'm curious to know how that difference works in team dynamics. You know, do you do things as a team together, going to you know, support sick kids or running relays and races? They probably don't let you do that because you might hurt yourself. But can you talk about that aspect of sports?
Yeah. So actually, Jill Nicholas is a junior. Oh my gosh, she's a junior already on our team, and she is one of the greatest kids I've ever met in my life. She actually started a program where we do community service on the road before our Friday games for Big Ten. So we just, when we were in Iowa, we went to Ronald McDonald House and, you know, helped us what we could. We made some snack bags and made some meals for the families there. We just went to Nebraska and we did kind of a workout with the kids there, getting them active. And it was kind of, we didn't realize, but it was a school where a lot of the kids there don't really have much. There were some kids there who were homeless. So just going there and seeing what the kids are going through, I mean, it's easy for us to do community service when we have all that we have and the opportunities that we have. But so we do a lot as a team. There's actually a competition for Illinois athletes, the most community service and attending each other's games. So we're always trying to win that. So that helps. We, you know, go out and just hang out with the kids in our community. A few of us, I remember I went with Tracy and Dylan Casley, and we read to kids at a school. I mean, they're very easy things that we can do just to make a difference in their lives. And, you know, like you said, it's not for the photo op. It's something that we can do. I have 2 classes right now, so it's really easy to go out and help out some kids, hang out with some kids. But, you know, those are the kids who grow up wanting to come to U of I and looking up to the athletes here and hopefully being better people because we spent 5 minutes with them. So it's something so easy that we can do, but I like to think it makes a big difference.
I think we could all learn from that. It's not just athletes. It's everybody. That's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Nicole Evans, standout softball player here at the University of Illinois. By the way, we should mention before we let you go, all-time leader in RBIs, one away from the all-time record in home runs. I know you told me off the air you don't really look at stuff like that, but it's got to feel pretty good, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, the coaching staff that we have really came in and helped us build up our swings, build up our confidence, and it's helped everyone. All of our stats are up. I don't really look at my stats, but everyone keeps telling me about them, so I think it's cool. but whatever I can do for the team, that's what I'm going to do.
Awesome. Well, we're glad you joined our team for the Bandwagon podcast here today, Nicole. Thanks so much, and go get those Badgers this weekend.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
I said, blue moon of Kentucky, keep on a shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. Blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
All right, we are going to be joined right now by Molly Pagansky. Molly is a former Champaign-Urbana resident who grew up in Louisville. I am familiar with her interest in the Kentucky Derby, thanks to annually being invited to Derby parties at her house every year when they lived here, and certainly miss going to those. Do you have those in Minneapolis now where you live?
Yeah, we do. We had to skip a year because we lived in an apartment with no outdoor space and we didn't have any friends yet, so we skipped. I think that was 2015, but we had one last year, and we're going to have one this year in a couple weeks. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, if any of us end up in town, we'll be sure and stop by.
All right.
But in general, we were just wondering. You know, you grew up in Louisville, and I think we've talked about this. We're off mic when you weren't here, but obviously. But you know, in terms of sporting events tied to an area, certainly. Is very few that rival sort of the Kentucky Derby and sort of the pomp and circumstance that surround it. So can you just talk a little bit about what it's like to actually live in the region and what the buildup to the Derby is like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really big deal, as you say. There's a two-week festival leading up to the day of the race. It's the Kentucky Derby Festival, and it starts with Thunder Over Louisville, which is a fireworks show that I think is the biggest fireworks show in the country. And so they have two barges in the river with a bridge in between them, and they simultaneously launch the same fireworks off of the two barges, and then they, like, waterfall fireworks into the river off of the bridge. And so growing up and, like, going to that with my family as a kid, it was just amazing. Really, really big, fun, crowded time down on the Ohio River. And then there's also, like, a steamboat race. There's a balloon glow with hot air balloons. There are, like, loads and loads of parties and street festivals and that kind of thing all leading up to the Derby, which is the first Saturday in May, and it's a huge economic driver for the city and the region because people, as you know, come in from all over the country and the world to attend the parties and the race. So, yeah, it's a big deal. I didn't grow up in the neighborhood where Churchill Downs is, so I imagine if you did, it could be, like, pretty annoying to all of a sudden have a couple hundred thousand people, like, trying to park in front of your house. But it as a kid, it was really fun.
Can you talk a little bit about, in terms of economic development, which you just mentioned, you know, it's a big economic driver. Is the planning for the festival and for the race itself kind of going on all year? Are a lot of activities in Louisville? I realize there's a lot more to the area than just the Derby, but it's but it is huge. I mean, it's a huge deal. And if it were to go away, I think it would have a really terrible effect on the city. So is there a lot of planning going on year-round or a lot of discussion about the Derby year-round, or is it pretty much just sort of ramping up like once you hit New Year's and everybody starts thinking about it?
I think there's probably discussion year-round among, like, you know, the committees of people who work on this kind of stuff. And there's, like, organizations that do fundraising for like local charities and stuff year round that has to do with the Derby as well. So, yeah, to your point, if it went away, I mean, it's so many millions of dollars that come into the region. And I mean, horse racing is just a really big deal across the whole state. I think it's weird though, because like the people that can afford to go to the Derby, are wealthy, very wealthy people. Like I looked at ticket prices this morning out of curiosity, and prices for a seat at the Derby are like $300 and up.
Wow.
That's the low. That's the cheapest seat you can buy, and it's Churchill Downs is situated in like a pretty working class neighborhood. So I think there's probably a weird push and pull between like this extreme wealth for this small time of the year versus like these everyday people who are, you know, just, you know, happen to live in Louisville and don't necessarily want anything to do with this big horse race because they aren't really into horse racing. So, yeah, it's interesting.
I'm curious, Molly, have you ever actually gone to the race itself?
I have gone to the Oaks, and that is a race the day before, so the first Friday in May, I guess, or the Friday right before the first Saturday in May. And it is a really similar feel, like a lot, again, a lot of pomp and circumstance. People get really dressed up, but it's a lot less expensive. And the Oaks is a race of fillies, which are female horses. And so you can go to that for maybe like $60 to $100 for like the cheapest seat. So one year I decided like, okay, I need to do this. And it was a lot of fun, but like, I felt like I was playing dress up, you know?
When you're growing up and you're in that environment, do people like does your school get excited? Do you all like pick out horses? I mean, is it part of the culture that much, or is it kind of like you said, more of like what the wealthy people do, and for everyone else is just kind of the festivities surrounding it?
I think a little bit of both. I don't remember like any programming in my school regarding it, but I do know that on Oaks Day, the day before, Jefferson County Public Schools, the Louisville Metro Public School System, are closed because no one wants to go to work for like this big party weekend. But I remember with my family, like, you know, the paper would release like the list of horses, and I'm a graphic designer, so like as a kid, I would be drawn to like, ooh, this horse has like the prettiest silk, like the jockey has like the coolest colors, so like that's who I'm picking, or like this horse has like a really interesting name, so that's who I'm picking. So all of my decisions were based totally separate of like any odds or you know, wanting to bet or anything like that. But I remember having fun as a kid doing stuff like that. And year-round, like Churchill Downs is open. Well, not year-round, but seasonally it's open. And so, like, my dad would take me to Dawn at the Downs, and that's where really early in the morning the horses are running the track to exercise and practice and stuff. And you can go for, like, not very much money and just kind of watch them and walk around. And it's a really beautiful old historic building. So that was always really interesting and fun. And, you know, as, like, an 8-year-old girl in Kentucky, like, you're into horses.
So you mentioned, so we talked about economic impact, and I want to talk a little bit about cultural impact too. And you mentioned getting really dressed up. So I think even those of us who are not super nerds for horse racing understand that the Derby is like a place where you show off your hat if you're a woman or a guy, and see your sucker suits. And like, I have this idea of like the aesthetics, at least in terms of clothing. And then there's also the food. My question is partially about like what is your experience or understanding while living in Louisville about those aspects of the race, and also do any of those aspects of the race infiltrate your party?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the mint julep is sort of one of the iconic things about the Derby. So it's crushed ice, bourbon, sugar, and then like a giant sprig of mint. If you get one at Churchill Downs, they'll give you like, I don't know, an absolutely enormous piece of mint that would cost like $4 at the grocery store. So that in the Kentucky Derby glass is a big deal. And also there's this sandwich called the hot brown, and then there's this like meat stew called burgoo. So like all of these sort of Louisville and Kentucky based foods are definitely a big part of the festival. And yeah, like the big hats, and everybody like dressed to the nines and looking really fancy. So when we throw our little party every year in the backyard, we definitely do the mint juleps. And someone told me recently like the perfect place to get that crushed ice, so I'm excited this year to up my mint julep game a little bit.
Well, let's see. So you're having a party this year. So what's on the menu?
Let's see. We usually do it potluck style. So we usually provide the bourbon and the mint and everything and ask people to bring food. And then, like, if the weather's nice, we'll probably do some barbecue or do some grilled food. So that's a good question. I should work more on my menu. But sort of like, you know, early summer food. So, like, salad, you know, burgers, hot dogs, let's see. Yeah, that kind of stuff. That's a good question. Also, I should mention, of course, Derby Pie. There's a company in Louisville that has trademarked Derby Pie. So if you knock it off and you make it yourself, you have to call it, like, Kentucky Horse Race Pie. but it's made of chocolate and nuts. So it's sort of like a pecan pie, but instead of that, like, corn syrup stuff at the base, it's chocolate. Wonderful.
That sounds awesome.
So, yeah, I think... we're going to have to wrap it up here, but before we go, Molly, I was wondering, you said you don't really pick horses based on odds. Can you give us any tips in terms of horse picks, in terms of what you look for in a name or anything like that?
In a name? Well, I just remember, it's probably like 10 or more years ago now, there was a horse named Fusaichi Pegasus, and I was just like, wow, that's cool. I've never heard anything like that. So I picked that horse that year. And that horse had 50-1 odds, and it ended up winning. Oh. So that means that whoever ended up betting on that horse won way more money than if you had bet on a horse with 2 or 4 or 6-1 odds. So I would say if you actually want to win money, like, you know, you bet based on, like, better odds or slightly better odds. My husband's father always says, like, you never buy the cheapest thing. You buy the second cheapest thing. So maybe the best way to do it is not bet on the horse with the best odds, but the second best odds, and then you'll do okay. But as far as a name or colors go, I just pick the most interesting or flamboyant thing that catches my eye.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for giving us the inside scoop on Louisville, and tell Joel I said hello.
Sounds good. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Molly.
Bye.
Well, normally it would be rivalry time,
mm-hmm.
but your bandwagon podcast co-host has dropped the ball. Fumble, turnover.
wild pitch wild in pitch. The dirt.
Whatever you want to say.
More like didn't even show up for the game.
Well, I'm here.
Yes.
I showed up. I just didn't bring all of my materials. So yes, we'll have to put off the rivalry until next time. Although, as Lisa pointed out here, as we were talking before the episode, there might be a bit of a rivalry going on at ESPN today, as we're recording this on Wednesday morning. And you know, hate to joke about something like this, but a lot of folks at ESPN are losing their jobs today. There's several writers that I'm sure people are familiar with. Ed Werder from their NFL coverage is one guy who announced on Twitter that he's being laid off. Dana O'Neill, very good college basketball writer for ESPN, is losing her job. So sad day there at ESPN, and I think it kind of points, guys, to kind of the changing media landscape going on right now.
Absolutely. I feel terrible, and it's not over. I mean, we're still pretty early in the day, so I don't know. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, very sad indeed. Anyone on that list we've seen so far kind of stand out to you, John?
Well, I just thought Dana O'Neill was surprising, but I guess it's not surprising. They're also discussing reduced roles for a lot of the on-air hosts. Given what we know about the industry, though, I don't think it's surprising. I think these are a long time coming, and I also think they've actually had a lot of layoffs at ESPN over the last 5 or 6 years, but this is the first one where some of the more on-air and name talent are getting sort of the boot, so to speak.
Quick question for you on that. Do you think it's because of the diversification now of, like, Major League Soccer has its own app, or, like, you know, all of these sports, tennis has its own app for over-the-top, you know, viewing? Do you think because there's more specialization where people can just watch soccer or tennis or whatever all the time that they don't feel like they need ESPN anymore?
I think ESPN is finally – they've been sort of stream-proof. Over the years, because live sports has sort of been the thing that people subscribe to, and I think you're seeing that that's no longer the case. I think that's the biggest hit they're taking, is that they're losing subscribers across the country tooth and nail, because people are pulling the cord. And before, people would pull the cord, but not the sports fans. And now, because there's places to stream soccer, or, you know, Major League Baseball now has a streaming app,
right.
and if you're smart enough, you can figure out how to do it the back end way as well. So I think that's really what's driving this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, sad day at ESPN here today. So we'll see what happens as sports media continues, and hopefully those folks can find work at, you know, another network, another publication, or whatever the case may be. I think it is time for our status update. John, let's start with you.
Let's start with me because I even told Brian ahead of time that I was taking this one, because there's been a couple times the last couple weeks where you jump in and usurp my
I know that happened at least once.
In my mind, it happened 100 times. Probably just happened once. Last night in the Major League Baseball, the Toronto Blue Jays are playing the Cardinals, and someone, we'll call him Joe Baseball, hit the ball very far, almost to a home run, didn't quite go out. Chris Coughlin, who is a former Cub, current Blue Jay, running around the bases, their throw home to Yadier Molina beat him by a lot. In the olden days, what would have happened was Coughlin would have slammed into Molina, probably both of them. One of them would have pulled out a knee, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, because you can't do that anymore, Coughlin decided to jump over Yadier Molina and do a flip, landed basically head on home plate. It's pretty amazing. It's actually kind of lucky that he didn't hurt himself. And
was he safe?
He was safe. Anyway, incredible play, fun to watch, and just like Brian, I always love to see things like that happen to the Cardinals.
Absolutely. That was wonderful. And the Cardinals ended up losing that game in 11 innings, too, so that was fun. I've got a quick one, also baseball-related. There is a player from Milwaukee named Eric Thames, who had been out of Major League Baseball for, like, the last 3 or 4 years. He had come up, had a few years where he was kind of back and forth between AAA and the major leagues, and did okay but not great. He went and played in Korea for, like, 3 years and put up just incredible numbers over there, great power numbers, high batting average, everything. Milwaukee's kind of in a rebuilding mode, and so they decided to sign this guy and kind of take a chance on him. They didn't know how well he would, you know, do in the major leagues after being in Korea for 3 years. Well, all he's done so far is lead the major league is in home runs. He has 11 home runs on the season, 8 of them against Cincinnati. And as sometimes will happen with a guy like this who kind of comes out of nowhere, evidently he's been asked about performance-enhancing drugs. And he's already apparently been tested a couple times. And he had a great quote last night that I saw on Twitter. The quote says, "If people keep thinking I'm on stuff, I'll be here every day. I have a lot of blood and urine."
Whoa.
So Eric Thames kind of been enjoying his time in the spotlight with all his blood and urine. So that's my status update.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll bat cleanup here. mine is actually not about baseball. I just noticed this morning. Mine's about public service. And I just noticed this morning that Just Not Sports, the podcast hosted by Sarah Spain and Julie DeCaro, won a Peabody for their work on the More Than Mean project. That was a hashtag. Gosh, I don't know. How long ago was that? You interviewed Julie about this. Did you not? Brian?
Well, not about that project specifically, but about her experiences on social media, which kind of led to this project.
So the whole idea, and I'll just read very briefly, short videos, simple message was about civility online. More Than Mean is extremely powerful 4 minutes that talk about the silence around abusive women in sports journalism and a reflection on the toxic treatment of women online in general. They won a Peabody, you know, praise be. Yep. Yeah. So shout out to those women in the Just Not Sports podcast, which actually on its is actually a really interesting podcast where they talk to sports figures about anything, just not sports. So I think it's pretty cool. But the work that they've done to raise awareness about how women are treated online in general, but particularly in the realm of sports journalism, is top notch. So nicely done.
Absolutely. Well, with that, kids, I think we are just about out of time.
Right. Once again, I did not write real credits, so I'm gonna make them up as I go.
We'll do it live.
Vamp right now.
Tribute and, to recently fired.
Yeah. Yeah, we could read the ESPN updates. Can I go? I'll make them short.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, thank you to everybody for joining us on the bandwagon today. This episode, oh, especially Molly. Thanks, Molly. And thanks, Nicole, for coming in. Like, that was super cool.
Double guest.
Two guests. That's like sort of a milestone for us. This episode was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbacher. Other people who have helped out with Bandwagon in the past, present, and hopefully the future, too. Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, and of course, REM, who do our theme music. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon, where we link to just about everything we discuss here. Better yet, you can subscribe to us and rate us, that sounds fun, in iTunes, which helps people discover us, and we want to be discovered. If you don't have iTunes, that's fine. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast. That's all consonants, no vowels. We promise we'll be better at updating. I think my last update there was on April 12th, so we're a little bit behind. We also all have our own Twitter accounts, and you can follow us there. We like everything, links, questions, etc. We'll be back in a couple of weeks for another episode about the sometimes strange intersections between sports and everything else. Until then, thanks for playing.